Thanks so much for joining us today on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller. We're talking about tax filing preparation on the show with Mary Mellum of Ashwaubenon Tax Professionals. She's been with us many times, does a wonderful job. She and her husband, David, have been in the tax business for more than 30 years, serving individuals. They consult other tax professionals, and they teach tax seminars around the country. So as we talk with Mary, I hope you'll join in. What questions do you have about your taxes? You can call us at 800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. Or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. ideas@wpr.org. Mary Mellum, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Thanks. It's nice to be here.
Before we talk about the 2022 taxes, what do we need to know about energy credits for this year?
Well, for 2022, the only energy credit we have is the maximum lifetime $500 credit that many, many, many people have already used up their energy credit. So for most people, the energy credits for 2022 will not be available. But in 2023, the energy protocol, so to speak, has been revamped, and the energy credit starting in that year for, and what I'm talking about is basically the home energy, the windows and the doors and the insulation, that kind of thing that we've been used to in the past. It is now as much as an annual amount of $1,200 cumulative annually. There are specifics for different kinds of things, like there's a maximum for windows and a maximum for doors and things like that. But together, it is a $1,200 annual expense up through the year, I believe, 2032.
Oh, so quite a ways, 10 years.
So have it out there. But it's a wonderful opportunity for people who are, for instance, replacing their windows, that they don't have to do them all at once and will still be able to get an energy credit larger than they've had in the past.
Yeah, good deal there. What about electric vehicle credits?
The electric vehicle credits, there is a big push on electric vehicles. The electric vehicle credit is still the $7,500 credit, but it's kind of a new slate for the vehicle companies that have it out there. In the past, we've had the energy credit or the electric vehicle credit, but once a company had sold a certain amount, the credit for that type of vehicle was exhausted.
Got it.
All starting with a new slate, starting in basically in 2023. There are some things. In 2022, there still is a credit, but again, it's based on what's kind of left over. So it is up to a $7,500 credit. There is a catch to it. The new vehicles must be, final assembly must be in North America. So that includes the United States, Mexico, and Canada, basically. But if they are not, if they do not meet that condition, they don't qualify for the credit. And the IRS has some good fact sheets out for people to know what vehicles are available and things like that.
Hmm.
So, and one other caveat to it, it does apply to used electric vehicles. There are certain criteria and certain specifics that have to be met to get that, but this is the first time it's a $4,000 maximum credit for the used electric vehicles.
And is it going to be easy enough to claim these credits on our 2023 taxes?
They will have a form available for it. One of the catches is they will need the VIN number of the vehicle.
Mm.
And the dealers that are selling these things have the information. I suspect that people that will come to visit us will be willing to tell us that they bought an electric vehicle and fill out the forms. But yes, it will be similar to how it was done in the past. There is a form for that. But again, the VIN number is the way that the IRS will be keeping track of the vehicles. With the used vehicle, the credit can only be claimed once on a used vehicle. So they need to keep track of the original, the VIN number for the original credit, the VIN number for the used vehicle. And once that VIN number has been used basically twice, it's out of the system and can't be used again.
Any other changes that we should be thinking about as the year goes on?
There are the budget bill that was signed at the end of the year does have provisions for retirement plans, and there are some things in there that progressively go through the years. One of the things that doesn't take effect until a few years down the road is the required minimum distribution date for people who are retired. For a long time, it was 70 and a half. We have recently moved to age 72, and with this latest bill, it will go to 73 and 75 over the next several years.
Mm. Okay.
So, just some interesting, things with retirement programs, but nothing that in these two bills that were signed this year, for the most part, it affects 2023 and later, not the 2022 return.
Peggy in Madison has a question for you. Let's go there. Peggy, hi.
Good morning. Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I have a question. I'm changing insurance after many years under the ACA health care. I'm moving, I started January 1st with an employer who will offer me health care. My ACA plan was a high deductible, and so I had an HSA card. My new plan is not a high deductible. So my understanding is that that money on the HSA card stays there forever. But my question is, for 2022, can I put more money on that HSA card since I had a high deductible for the year of 2022, or did that end when that plan ended?
For your HSA contribution, you can make a contribution. I'm assuming your health care changed in 2023. Is that correct?
Starting January 1st.
Okay. So, yes, you have until April 15th to make the contribution. If you were covered for a full year, your contribution, depending on whether you're a single person or whether it's a family plan, you could fill out, you could contribute for 2022 to maximize that up to April 15th.
There you go. Thanks, Peggy. Appreciate your call. A listener called to ask, and couldn't stay with us, about the current tax code or what the current tax code says about cryptocurrency. And we did want to mention there's something on the form now about cryptocurrency as well, the tax form.
Well, cryptocurrency is a very interesting topic, and it is front and center right after you fill in your name and address on the tax return. There is a question, and this year it has its own title. It's called Digital Assets. But the question basically asks, did you receive, sell, send, exchange, or otherwise dispose of any interest in digital assets? And digital assets include virtual currency, which is what the IRS called it on the 21 return, and something we call non-fungible tokens. Basically, it's owning an interest in something that you can't touch or feel. And that's what the crypto world is.
So that is on the form this year, and it's something just to look for, and we're probably most people, they're not going to have much to worry about there.
Well, there are more and more people that are, I might use the word dabbling, in the cryptocurrency world. And if you are doing it at all, and you are doing more than just buying it and putting it on a shelf, the answer to the question is yes. And if you answer that question yes, in all probability, the IRS is looking for a transaction on that return.
Mm. Okay.
And there is a whole lot to it that we could talk about.
Okay. Jim emailed, he's a disabled veteran, has taxes. His taxes are incredibly simple every year. Disability income and property tax for veterans credit are about it. However, he hasn't been able to find a way to file electronically without a fee. And wonders if you, he says any help would be appreciated.
The IRS, at the IRS website, there is what's called the Free File Program. And the Free File Program is available based on income limits to participate in it. And it covers the federal tax return. The state of Wisconsin also has the ability to electronically file through the Wisconsin Department of Revenue website. So if the income is not too high for the free file program, it should be out there available. Go to irs.gov and type in free file, and you should be able to find information from there.
Let's take a call from Ron in Manitowoc County. Ron, hi. Thanks for calling.
Thanks, Larry. Mary, any special way of treating income from a tree harvest, forms to use, et cetera?
There is, if you are doing it just as a cleanup mode and not being in the business of timber, it is a Schedule D transaction. The form is 8949 that you would report the proceeds. And if you have a cost basis, which many people do not allocate a cost basis when it's an occasional sale of that, it would be the sale of a capital asset, and it's as simple as that.
Oh, pretty straightforward.
The business, in the timber business, then there are special forms for that, and there is depletion and a number of other aspects that you need to be careful of.
There you go, Ron. Thank you for calling. Appreciate it. Nancy in Plainfield, on to you now. Hi, Nancy.
Hi. Yeah, I have a question. My husband and I were senior citizens, and we had to purchase a new furnace and AC this year, and we were wondering if there's anything. It was a propane one, so we were told there was no energy benefit that we could get, but we were wondering if there's any tax break.
And by this year, do you mean 2023, Nancy?
No, we put in during the last summer, so
okay.
2022.
Okay.
So the first question I would ask is, have you ever taken advantage of energy credits in the past?
No.
Okay.
Not that I can recall.
Okay. If you had, and they have been in existence for a very long time, I think probably 2006 was the most recent series of it. And if you have taken advantage of that any time in the past, you probably don't have anything left. If you did have something left, then there were energy credits available in 2022. There is, for furnaces, there is a certain specification that it had to be a 95% efficient furnace to qualify for the credits. I would certainly, the person who installed your furnace is usually the one that has the specifications, and they should know whether it's something that qualifies for it. But it did exist.
All right. Nancy, there you go. Thank you very much for calling. Mary Mellum, our guest today, tax professional from Green Bay, Wisconsin, who's been in the tax business for more than 30 years with Ashwaubenon Tax Professionals. Our guest today, Jill Nadeau, our producer, Tyler Ditter, our engineer. I'm Larry Mueller for the Ideas Network. Taking a look at your taxes today with Mary Mellum, tax professional from Green Bay, Wisconsin. She and her husband, David, operate Ashwaubenon Tax Professionals. And we will go back to the phones, and John in Green Bay has a question. John, hi.
Hi. I'm required to take required minimum distributions, and in 2022, I refinanced an IRA certificate, quote, refinanced an IRA certificate of deposit to get a higher interest rate. Is the money that the credit union took from me as a penalty for early withdrawal considered a distribution out of that IRA, and as such, would that make me liable for some kind of a tax penalty since the government didn't get a tax payment on that money?
Generally, any fees that go on inside the IRA are not considered a distribution to you at all. It goes into your total amount of your IRA. I'm not familiar with the term that you used about the refinancing of an IRA contract. But when you establish an IRA and put money into it, that money inside of it goes into all, you know, whatever you want to invest in within the rules. And any of the fees and things that are paid inside that account just reduce the amount of money in your account. And each year, there is a formula for how much, once you reach age 72, there is a formula for how much you have to take out of it. So I'm assuming that if you were required to take some out, that you did meet that requirement in 2022. Because if you did not, then there is a 50% penalty for not having taken it out.
Hmm. There you go, John. Thank you very much for calling. You can join in, too. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Give a call. Pauline emailed to confirm that she doesn't have to do anything with required minimum distribution this year. She's 72, but must start withdrawals next year when she's 73.
The rule for if you turn 72 in 2022, you have a required distribution for 2022. If it is your first year, you have an extension, so to speak, to take it out for 2022, and that extension goes to April 1st of 2023. But if she turns 72 in 2022, then she is required to take it out for that year. And she has until April 1st to make that year's RMD. And then for 2023, again, she'll have to take out the one for 2023.
Okay.
Age 73 is something that's coming in the future. It is not, does not apply to this year.
Okay. John in Kimberly, we go to you now. Hi, John. Thank you for calling.
Hey, I got a question about HSA and Medicare and taxes. Last June, I decided to retire at 67 in last October. And, of course, I turned 67 in October. And when I went to get my insurance, they told me that I couldn't have an HSA and Medicare at the same time. I said, okay, fine. But I looked back at my documents, and Medicare always backdates if you're over 65, they backdate that you're starting of Medicare 6 months. So my Medicare started in December of the previous year, and so all that money that I put into my HSA now becomes taxable. And that I realize I wish there was a way around it, but that's just life. That's the way Medicare works. Do you have any idea what that penalty is going to be for putting that money in an HSA retroactively?
Well, for the HSA, if you have made an excess contribution to the HSA, you have a certain amount of time to take it out. But if it, until it's taken out, if it is in excess, there is a 6% penalty that is associated with that. And there is a form 5329 that does help calculate that penalty. And yes, the rule is correct that once you become eligible for Medicare, that's basically the way it speaks to, that you can no longer have an HSA. Now, if you've contributed for a time after the fact contribution that allocated to a period that you were qualified, maybe it's not all subject to the penalty. And also, like I say, there is a certain amount of time that you can take an excess contribution and get it out of there without being subject to the penalty. Earnings on it would be a taxable event and could be subject to the penalty. But I would certainly talk to someone who knows about HSAs and ask them about being able to take it out. You know, check with your financial institution that is holding the HSA and, you know, maybe someone there is knowledgeable in it and can look at the dates that you're associated with and know how long, you know, whether you're in those dates to be able to take it out.
There you go, John. Thank you so much for calling. Chris in La Crosse, on to you now. Hi, Chris.
Hi. So I just wanted to let the listeners know that the IRS Free File program is not quite as simple as you might hope, because the IRS doesn't actually have any free filing software on their website. What they have is, if you go to their Free File website, is links to all of the major tax preparation softwares, online software companies out there. And those software companies like TaxAct and the other ones, I can't think of the names, have a free filing option if you make less than something, some amount, like the guest said, like I think it's $75,000 maybe. You file with that online software, but the complicated thing is that when you go to those free filing versions, they make you jump through a bunch of hoops and they try and sell you on their non-free version. So if you're trying to use the free file software, just know that it's going to be kind of complicated. They're going to try and sell you on their non-free version. So buckle up and get ready to pay attention closely to all the questions they ask you and make sure that you work through all of the questions to stay on the free version if that's what you want.
All right. Chris, thanks for calling. Appreciate your call. Go ahead, Mary.
She is correct. The IRS right now is not in the business of providing free software. They have, for a number of years, had a partnership with certain software companies, and it is not all of the major software companies. There are a number of companies, and she is exactly right. When you go to the IRS website, it will walk you through going online, and you have to choose which company you want to go with. And again, it is how you answer the question, how it is. And the IRS program covers the federal return. It does not cover the state return. And that is some of where they're doing the charges for it is, if you want the full-blown package, the state return is not part of the free file program. But Wisconsin does allow people, and I don't know the conditions, if there's income limitations or things like that, but Wisconsin, the actual Department of Revenue, does have an electronic filing ability through the state of Wisconsin. And your federal and your state are two separate things.
Yep, absolutely. There we go. Good to have that all clear. Betty in Colgate, your turn. Hi, Betty.
Hi. I was just wondering if you could briefly go through some of the rules on capital gain. We inherited some land a couple of years ago. We're not able to sell it quickly, and the land appreciated, and now we're going to be hit with a pretty substantial capital gain, and I just wondered how it works.
Okay. Couple of things here. Capital gain is a type of property that is subject to a different tax rate than ordinary income property. Currently, capital gain property has either a 0% capital gain rate, a 15% capital gain rate, or a 20% capital gain rate. The zero capital gain rate, and when I'm talking about that, it's long-term capital gains that we're talking about. Anyone who is in the 12% or lower tax bracket has zero capital gain rate. The 15% capital gain rate goes there until you get into the higher income levels, and we're looking around $400,000 that a married couple could have for income before it triggers the 20% capital gain rate. And basically, if you inherit property, any property that you sell, and capital gain is not going to apply until you actually sell that property. But when you inherit property, the value of the property at the date of the person's death that you inherited it from becomes your cost basis in the property. When you sell property, the difference between what you receive for it and your cost in that property is what is subject to capital gain. And land itself is not a depreciable asset. Now, it may have gone down in value from the time that you inherited it, but it is not depreciable if you're talking about just land itself. So you may have lost money on it because it was valued higher when you sold it, but that wouldn't give you a capital gain. That could give you a loss in that case. The state of Wisconsin has capital gain rules that do not exactly match the federal, but you still get a break on the capital gains for Wisconsin. There's a lesser part of it, about usually 70% of the gain is subject to tax at the Wisconsin level at the regular rates.
Betty, thank you again for calling. Let's go to Lou in Mosinee next. Hi, Lou.
Hello, Larry. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I just tuned in and don't know if you discussed it yet, but I'm selling my house that I got a solar credit for about 3 years ago, and I'm going to build a new house this year, and I'm planning on installing solar again. Can I get another tax credit for this, or is there a maximum solar tax credit I can get in my lifetime?
That's a good question, and I do not, off the top of my head, know the answer to that. I would suspect that you are able to get it on your home the next time you install it in there. My only question was, is there a long enough period? Do you have any recapture of the credit? And I'm not positive about that, depending on the time. But if you install a new solar system in your new main home, I don't see why you wouldn't qualify for a credit on that basis.
Yeah, there you go, Lou. Thank you. Bruce in Green Bay, your turn. Hi, Bruce.
Hi. I just wanted to know if under the new tax law, if I buy a battery-powered snowblower, does that qualify for any of the tax breaks?
I'm not aware of any of the tax breaks on a battery-powered snowblower.
Or lawnmower, probably, either.
No, I'm not. The electric vehicles, there were, I believe, two-wheel electric vehicles that were still allowed for credits. But basically, the electric vehicles that we're talking about are passenger vehicles or road-sensitive vehicles.
Bruce, there you go. Thank you. You can join in, too, by the way. The number to call is 1-800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. I have some open lines, get you on fairly quickly. Let's go to Milt in Shawano County next. Hi, Milt.
Hello. I'm selling 5 acres of ag land to a younger couple to build a house on. Are there any tax benefits or requirements I should be aware of before or after the sale?
The only thing, if you're going through a broker or a closing agent, there are some filing requirements in terms of it's a 1099-S if you're selling land that has to be filled out. Usually it's the closing agent that is responsible for that. If it is ag land and you have any special programs that you have gotten through the Department of Agriculture or something like that, there could be some recapture or some zoning differences, but they're not tax issues. So the only tax issue that I can think of is the need for filing the 1099-S with regard to the sale, and then, of course, you reporting the sale on your personal tax return.
Yep. There you go. Thank you so much for calling. Bill in Cottage Grove, your turn. Hi, Bill.
Hi, Larry. I'm having a trouble. My wife passed away about 4 years ago, but she authored books, and I'm getting royalties from those books. And the IRS seems to look at me as being self-employed or some other term other than single. And what is the correct classification for someone like myself when I'm filing my income tax?
Well, as far as the classification of you filing your income tax, if you have not remarried since the time she died, then you're a single taxpayer. Are these royalties coming on a 1099 in her name?
No, they're in my name now.
Okay. I don't know. Are they trying to charge you with self-employment tax?
Yes.
It is my understanding that you should not be subject to self-employment tax on the royalties because you were not the creator of those. That she was the creator, you received the property from her, but it shouldn't, it's my understanding, it shouldn't be subject to self-employment tax. Is there a possibility that on a past return, your name was showing on the Schedule C rather than hers, that associated it with you rather than her, and they're confused about that?
Well, perhaps, and I don't really know the answer to that question, but that's certainly a possibility.
In your case, you're still receiving those royalties, and they would be royalties subject to tax. But again, it would be more like income in respect of a decedent rather than being actual business income to you. Do you do your own tax return?
I do.
Are you reporting them in the same way that you reported them when she was alive?
If you're reporting
them on a Schedule C, that might be the problem.
I see. And how should I view them now?
I would, either report them as royalty on a Schedule E, or I would report them as other income, because you are not the one that performed the service or created the product to get those royalties. You're getting them secondhand, so to speak.
Hmm. Bill, there you go. Thank you for calling. Appreciate your call. Arnie in Beaver Dam, it's your turn. Hi, Arnie.
Well, hello there. I listen to your show quite a lot. I love it. I don't know if you covered this. I just got on board a few minutes ago. I received a property from my mother, and I got it through a quick claim deed. And I was just curious when I do, if and when I want to sell it, how much am I going to get taxed for that through a quick claim deed?
Okay. What I think you're telling me, Arnie, and correct me if I'm wrong, that your mother gifted you this property. You did not pay anything for it, and you did not get it as a result of her death.
Correct. She's still alive, and it was just a quit claim deed.
Okay. A quit claim deed that she signed over to you is her way of giving you a gift. And okay. Do you know what the value of this property is, roughly?
Roughly about $350,000, maybe $400,000.
That's enough to tell me. If she has not filed a gift tax return, it is important that she file a Form 709 gift tax return. There is no tax associated with that at this point in time. It's just telling the government that that property has moved from her to you. When filing that gift tax return, there is a column on the gift tax return that says, what is her basis in that property? That basis in that property is important because that becomes your cost in that property when you go to sell it. And so if down the road, if she had a cost in that property of, let's say, $100,000, when you sell it, that will be your cost in the property. And if you sold it at what you say it's worth now, that would be $300,000 minus the $100,000 cost, leaving you with a gain of $200,000 that would be subject to tax.
All right.
It is.
Thank you very much. That form number again?
709.
I appreciate it. Thank you so much.
Mm-hmm. Thanks for calling, Arnie. Appreciate your call. Our guest today, Mary Mellum, tax professional from Green Bay, who's been in the business a long time. She and her husband, David, operate Ashwaubenon Tax Professionals out of Green Bay. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Taking a look at your taxes today on the show, Larry Mueller here with my guest, Mary Mellum, tax professional with Ashwaubenon Tax Professionals in the Green Bay area. Love to have her with us. She does a great job. The lines are all filled. We've got some emails. Barbara emailed that the IRS thought she was dead for the last 2 to 3 years. She thinks she's finally gotten it straightened out, but she didn't get her stimulus checks. What does she do next?
When the stimulus checks were part of the tax return, they were automatically sent to some people. But if she did not get her stimulus check, then she needs to amend her tax return for those years or file a tax return for those years. And there were two on the 2020 return and one on the 2021 return. So that would be the way to claim them, would be to either initially file or to amend your tax returns for those 2 years.
Let's take a call from John in Barron, Wisconsin next. Hi, John.
Hi, how you doing today?
Good, appreciate the call. What's on your mind?
Just a quick, simple question. If I'm receiving SSDI, do I need to or should I file a tax return for both state and federal?
By SSDI, you're meaning it's a disability program that is not through the Social Security system. Is that correct?
Yeah, I believe so, yeah. I'm pretty sure it's SSDI.
You get a document from the Social Security system saying this is how much we paid you during the year?
I don't have a mailing address at the moment, so...
Okay.
Being homeless and stuff, it's hard to get mail.
If it is strictly SSI, which is usually the acronym that I would, it is because you do not, you're getting disability not because you have work credits, but you're getting it through another government program. If that's the case, the SSI is not a taxable situation.
There you go, John. Thank you.
As long as you don't have other income that would have caused you to file a tax return, you probably do not need to file a tax return.
John, thank you for calling. Appreciate it. Rena in Oak Creek. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hi, I realize that the ag land conversion fee is a property tax issue. But that gentleman who's selling 5 acres to a young couple that are going to turn it into residential, either the seller or the buyer has to pay the ag conversion property tax fee, adjustment, whatever. And if the real estate agent hasn't warned either one about it, the buyers are going to end up with a shock next year.
Rena, it sounds like you were speaking from experience. Mary, any comment?
That was kind of what I was referring to, not specifically like that, but the zoning and things like that can be fees on the sale that have nothing to do with income tax. And it certainly is important to know all of those things.
Yeah. Thanks, Rena. Appreciate it. Dennis in Oshkosh, on to you now. Hi, Dennis.
Yes, hi, Larry and Mary. I'm just trying to see if I have this right. I'm dealing with the sale of my mother-in-law's home. She has passed away. She's lived there well beyond 2 years, and the proceeds from it, the profit was about $107,000, which is under the $250,000. Does that mean I don't have to do anything, or do I still have to show it?
There's a whole different situation. That sale of residence exclusion does not apply to the sale of the property if your mother-in-law, if the sale was after she died. Am I assuming that the sale was after she died?
No, she was alive.
Okay, if it was sold while she was still living, then you are correct on her final, I'm assuming it was done just before she died, so it would be in the year of death?
Yes.
If it is her final tax return and it was sold before she died and she did live in it under normal circumstances 2 out of the last 5 years, if she had gone into a nursing home, that number might be a little bit less. But as long as she meets that and she is a single person and she did not use it for business, then she would get the exclusion of the gain. I always recommend that you report it on the tax return and exclude the gain so it is put down there and the IRS can't come back and say, you know, where is it?
Yeah.
It's kind of a final statement. But yes. Because it was sold before she died, she should be eligible for the exclusion, assuming she meets the conditions.
All right. There you go, Dennis. Thank you very much for calling. And let's turn to Tom in Madison next. Hi, Tom.
Good morning. Pleasure to hear this show. I have a question concerning the receipt of forms that you need to file, such as a 1099 or a W-2 or a Schedule K, whatever it may be, if it doesn't get to you in a timely manner, and you're using one of the IRS Unholy Alliance tax partners for their software, the longer you delay to file, they are increasing the costs of filing. But if a third party has not supplied you with the required documentation, it's kind of like a double jeopardy, penalizing you for not filing documents you have not yet received. Any advice on confronting that dilemma?
Well, Tom, that's interesting that you say that. I'm not aware. If you're going through the free file program, there shouldn't be any extra cost with it, whether you file on January 31st or April 15th. I don't know what companies are charging that way. But here's the deal about the forms. When it comes to a W-2, employers are supposed to have the W-2s out by January 31st. The W-2s and the 1099 NECs, which are the independent contractors, are due to the employees, independent contractors, and the IRS to be mailed by January 31st. Now, that allows some mail time and things like that before the IRS is going to get excited about you not receiving those. When it comes to other documents like 1099 interest and dividends and brokerage statements, they typically do not arrive before, especially the brokerage side of them, before February 15th, and some of those can get extensions. And if you have something called a K-1, they don't have to be out until the company, the entity, files its tax return. So there is nothing pretty much that anybody's going to do about it, about you not getting that form on, you know, in a convenient time for you. They have their due dates. If they do not get them out by their due dates, the IRS can fine the companies, but that's really not going to help you get them any sooner.
Yeah, yeah.
So I think you just have to be patient.
Be patient, Tom. Thank you for calling. Megan in Black Creek, your turn. Hi, Megan.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Sure.
My boyfriend and I have been together long term, and we don't really have any desire to get married from a ceremonial standpoint. But one common thing that we get told is that, but for taxes, you got to get married for the taxes. And we're like, is that actually true?
It depends on your situation. No, for tax purposes, it is not. There are certain advantages of being married. On the Wisconsin return, there is a married couple credit that comes along with it. If you have children, things might get a little stickier then as far as filing status and things like that. So I'm not sure if you're just two single people living together or if there are children involved.
There will be children involved at some point, yes. And we do have two mortgages together.
Okay. When it comes to children and the child tax credits and things like that, a person, one of two people, if you're not married, is going to claim that child. And there are special rules about who can claim the child. And not knowing your particular situation, you know, I don't know which one of you would be the one to claim it. So it depends on the situation. If you're looking for strictly a dollars and cents answer, it all depends on where the two of you are. But just filing a tax return, and I'm assuming you both work.
Yeah.
Just filing a tax return between two single people and a married couple without any children or things like that, typically being single is going to be a better tax rate than it is as a married couple. But the reason for marriage shouldn't be decided on a tax return. It's a whole different ball game as far as that goes. But if they're talking about things, different credits, different things like that, it is possible that that's why they're telling you that there are advantages to being married.
There you go, Megan. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. You can join in, too. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Or you can email us, the email address, ideas@WPR.org. Our tax professional, Mary Mellum, will be with us right up until 12:30 today, so you'll have time to call. But you can call right now. We got open lines, get you on pretty quickly, and we'll get you on right after we take a look at the news and find out what else is in store for us here in the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller. Talking about income tax preparation on the show today, Larry Mueller here. Thanks for being with us on the Ideas Network. Mary Mellum of Ashwaubenon Tax Professionals back with us. She and her husband David have been in the tax business more than 30 years. They serve individuals, they consult other tax professionals, and they teach tax seminars around the country. Join in with your questions. Number to call, 800-642-1234, or email to ideas@WPR.org. And let's take a call. Walter in Burlington, we'll go to you next. Thanks for calling, Walter.
Hi, how's it going?
Good. Appreciate the call.
Thanks for having me.
What can we do for you?
So I kind of have weird question. I'm active duty military. I sold my primary residence in another state. I moved to Wisconsin this year, and I have a rental property that I'm selling in this year, 2023. Now, obviously, the primary residence, I lived in it for over 2 years, so I shouldn't have to pay any taxes on that, and it was under $250. What about the rental property that I have not lived in and plan on selling? And what kind of, would I be doing any state taxes with that as well? Because the home of record thing kind of comes into play. It's just kind of confusing for me.
Okay. I agree with the personal residence sale that there are even extra time frames for active duty military that could give you even further than that. But if you've lived in it 2 out of the 5 years, there's no question that you could qualify. And I'm assuming that home was never a rental property or you didn't operate a business out of that home.
Yes, that's correct.
Okay. And so if you are single, you qualify for the $250,000 exclusion. As far as the rental property is concerned, the rental property, the sale of it, is subject to income tax. The difference between what you sold the property for and what you have invested in the property, so to speak, what you paid for it, your closing costs, any improvements that you've made to it, minus the depreciation that you claimed or should have claimed on the property. The difference between that cost factor and what you sold it for is taxable. It will be taxable, depending on the situation, it may be subject to capital gain rates, but it also will be taxable to the state of Wisconsin. Whether you are a resident of Wisconsin or not, Wisconsin, because it's real estate sold in the state of Wisconsin, you will need to file a Wisconsin return for it, whether you're a resident or not.
All right. There you go, Walter. Thank you for calling. Linda in Milwaukee, your turn. Hi, Linda.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I have a question about taxable Social Security. I'm 70. I started collecting Social Security in the middle of 2022. And I got a form from Social Security office saying that some of it or all of it may be taxable. So I went through the little form you're supposed to fill out and decide if any of it's taxable or not. And I'm still working, by the way. And my husband owns his own company, and we are a subchapter S. So his profit and loss goes on our personal taxes. There's nothing on that form to show any income or loss from a subchapter S, and he had a huge loss this year. So what I need to, how does that fit into that picture of whether my Social Security is taxable or not?
If you are filing a joint return, it is going to take into consideration your total adjusted gross income and half of your Social Security and add those together. And if you are over, I believe the numbers are 35,000 or over 42,000, up to 85% of it could be taxable.
I do the 1040, and it will take in consideration the loss that's coming through from his SE.
From his S-corporation, that should be, if he's allowed the loss, and that depends on, you know, whether he's an active participant and things like that, or basis, you know, basis issues with it, which I don't know without knowing more of the property. But whatever gets onto the tax return does affect your modified AGI, and it is that basis that decides if you're over the $35,000 or $42,000 with your modified AGI plus one half of your Social Security, it will be somewhat taxable.
Okay. Linda, thank you. Appreciate the call. Tom in McHenry. Thank
you. Hello there.
Hi. Thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Well, thank you very much for taking my call. I've tried a couple of times and never been successful. My question should be pretty simple. I'm basically cheap, and I pay my utility bills, and on there I pay a federal tax, and I pay a state tax, and in my case I have property in Wisconsin and property in Illinois. Is there some place when you file your taxes that you can, if you keep track, deduct your federal tax that you paid on utility bills and your state tax you've paid on utility bills?
The simple answer is no. Generally, those taxes are excise taxes. If they were sales tax and you itemize, the state sales tax could come into play on the itemized deduction form, but itemized deductions, the tax portion of it, income, sales, property tax, is limited to $10,000 per person. So it's highly unlikely that if that were the case, it would help you. Mm-hmm. Now, the utility bills for the property in Wisconsin, are they, is that rental property?
No. That's a cabin that I own.
You should already be taking the whole utility bill towards your rental expenses, and therefore it would be part of that.
If it was, yeah.
Otherwise, no.
Sorry, Tom. Thanks very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Jim and Stoughton, your turn. Hi, Jim.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I filed my deceased mother's federal income tax for 2020 in March of 2021, followed by Form 1310 in April. I haven't heard a word since. My question is there a look-back expiration on my deceased mother's 2020 federal income tax refund?
First of all, let me address that part of it, Jim. Yes, there is a statute of limitations of 3 years from the date it was filed, if it's timely filed, to be able to collect the refund. If it was already filed, that should not be a problem. You know, the statute of limitations should not be a problem for you getting it. The problem that I see, first of all, is that, and the Form 1310 was the proper form to include with it, because I assume you're the one that is going to collect any refund. But remember where 2020 landed. It landed in the middle of COVID, and the IRS is behind time. Unfortunately, some of the returns from that period seem to have evaporated, for lack of a better word. And so if you have not received it or received any correspondence from the IRS, one thing is you can try to call them, and good luck with that, but it is a possibility. Have you gone on to the IRS website to Where's My Refund and tried checking that out?
Yes, I've done that every month since April 2021, and
sure.
The answer hasn't changed on that website.
Okay. What the IRS has been telling people lately with returns that they haven't heard anything about is that they are suggesting that you refile the return. If you do that suggestion, I suspect, because it's been this long, it is either sitting on someone's desk because of the death in the 1310, or it fell through the cracks somewhere. Did you electronically file that return or paper file it?
Paper filed.
Okay. The paper file is the one with the bigger problem.
Okay.
If you could find a way to electronically file that return, that would certainly be the best way to get it to the IRS. If you want to refile the return, I would do the same way that you did with the others, have your signed document, the 1310, with it. I hope you kept a copy of the return you filed, and if you did, I would sign it with the same date, and I would attach a bright colored sheet of paper on the front of that tax return that says refiled return, original paper filed return, dated such and such, no communication, or something to the effect that they know that this is the second time that you have filed that 2020 return.
Good luck, Jim. Thank you for calling. AJ in Columbus, Wisconsin, your turn. Hi, AJ.
Hi. So I'm considering accepting a 1099 teaching position, first time ever. So I wanted to know, is there a way that I could save up, put money aside, so I don't have to pay when I file my tax return?
When you say you're accepting a teaching position, are you accepting it as an independent contractor?
Yes.
Okay. The best way to do that is to file estimated tax payments. They're quarterly payments, and that would be the way to send the money to the government and have it paid in so that when you file your taxes, you don't come up with an astronomical tax bill.
Yep.
Okay. So is there a place on the tax form for me to do this, or how do I go about that?
If you go to the IRS website, it is Form 1040-ES. And there are ways that you can even electronically file those extension payments. They're quarterly payments. They're usually due April 15th, June 15th, October 15th, and January 15th are the four estimated tax payment dates. And you should have a voucher, a 1040-ES for federal and a 1-ES if you want to pay state taxes ahead of time. But if you go to the website, you should be able to print out the voucher and fill it out.
Hmm. There you go, AJ. Thank you. And good luck with your position. Lawrence in Menominee, your turn. Hi, Lawrence.
Good morning, Larry. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have put in geothermal in my shop. My shop is used by me and my rental company that I have. I re-insulated because I was putting in geothermal. Is my insulation deductible?
There are investment energy credits because it's business property. That was the geothermal put in this year,
that,
in 2022?
That is correct. September, to be exact.
There are energy credits for the geothermal. I believe they still exist, but they're the business side of it, not the personal energy credits. And if you are doing things business-wise, there should also be, I believe your insulation will give you some kind of a benefit business-wise. So I would take a look at, I believe it's called for the business, the investment tax credit is where you would look for that.
Have a pleasant day, and I appreciate your help.
Yeah, thanks, Lawrence. Appreciate it. Let's go to Brian in Eau Claire next. Hi, Brian.
Hey, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Yeah, so I just have a question about a home that I purchased. It's a similar question to a gentleman prior, but so essentially I bought a home. I lived there for several years, and then my wife and I decided that we wanted to rent it out, and so we rented it out. The loan was still a residential loan. However, we did take like depreciation on it when, you know, through our tax accountant and whatnot. Now, after that, we sold it just this last February. And I guess my question for you is, since I lived there for, you know, a few years prior, am I still having to pay capital gains on that property?
The only way it can be considered your principal residence is from the date of sale. If you look back 5 years and you lived there out of those five years, then you would qualify for the personal residence exclusion, but you would end up paying some tax because of the depreciation you took. Or you would be including some of the income from that sale because of the depreciation. If you cannot meet 2 out of the last 5 years for that property, then it's sold as a rental, and it would the profit on it would be subject to tax, yes.
Brian, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. There was a question about the child tax credit. What has changed with the child tax credit?
For 2022, the child tax credit goes back to the pre-COVID numbers. So the child tax credit before we did the COVID change was a $2,000 credit for a child that is under the age of 17. That meets the conditions, but generally for under the age of 17 and a dependent credit of $500 for anyone that is over the age of 17 or 17 or over. So it just reverts back to the way it was before the extra money that we got as a result of COVID.
And someone else is wondering about the earned income tax credit. What is it for 2022?
The earned income tax credit, again, goes back to the same rules that it was before COVID. So you have to have earned income below a certain level and income below a certain level. Generally, you have to have a child that lives with you for more than half the year, and that credit is based on that. What's different this year is that during COVID, you were able to look at the income that you earned back in 2019 and base it on that rather than a lower income from the current year if it was better for you. And that doesn't exist anymore. And last year, the individual, the childless individual, was able to get earned income credit when they made up to, I believe it was about $20,000. That's gone back to the $10,000 level that it was before that as well. And the childless tax credit is available for someone age 25 to 65. And last year they changed the numbers that allowed more people to get it. So in 2022, it's the basic rules that we had in play before COVID happened.
Sherry in Wausau wonders if there are any tax credits when a spouse dies.
The answer to that question simply is, no, there aren't tax credits due to death. But in the year of death, if the couple files married jointly, in the year of death, that year is considered a joint return. So depending on when the person died, the income for the whole year might be lower, and yet they still get the full married couple, the exemption, the standard deduction for a married person. So it depends on how you look at tax credits. That's kind of a benefit that if they die early in the year, you get the full standard deduction for a married couple. But there aren't any death credits as such.
Have you been pretty busy, Mary?
Oh, yeah. There is never a time when it's not in the tax world.
Well, I tell you what, I really appreciate you taking the time. I know you are busy, and I thank you so much, and I hope you'll be back with us again and we can do this again.
That sounds wonderful.
Thank you, Mary. Mary Mellum of Ashwaubenon Tax Professionals. She and her husband David have been in the tax business for more than 30 years. And they serve individuals, people like you and me, and they consult other tax professionals, and they teach tax seminars around the country. So it's always great to have her come by. She really knows her stuff. Just looking ahead, it's Garden Talk Friday already. Garden Talk tomorrow. And we'll talk about winter pruning, and we'll talk about designing your garden for the coming year. And we'll also take a look at what you need to know about getting your seeds started. It's about getting closer to that time. That's Friday for Garden Talk, starting at 11. And you can hear the first hour on Saturday mornings at 6. Thank you all for listening, and I hope you will stay with us. Lots more in store on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller.